we are stronger when we are independent together.
For those who have not been to an underground show, for those who are more used to the Moda Center than maybe the underground stage set up under, you know, Morrison or any other bridge, as we've said before, or some abandoned warehouse, the list goes on. But for those listeners, what would they be missing out on if this were to continue with Live Nation's movement in Portland? And I guess, what is the overall value of having this scene for any Portlander who might be interested or might not be?
Live Nation makes it harder for organic opportunities for this industry to grow. It makes it harder for, I mean, there are already immense real estate pressures. There are immense, you know, we are in a growing, dense urban community. The reality of what my experience when I was in my 20s trying to do pop-up shows at the back of bike shops along Foster, or some of these venues are now fancy sushi restaurants, or you know, the Ash Street Saloon is now a Bay's Fried Chicken. Like, the city that I grew up in is gone. It may be that what we know of as the DIY scene is not going to be able to move forward the way it has. Those industrial spaces are getting busier. We need to create intentional pathways for everybody to have that. What Live Nation does, though, is it reduces competition. It reduces opportunities for innovation. And what they explicitly do is they try to monopolize all of the components of an industry. You know, in every city that they've opened a music venue, independent music venues have either been sold or gone out of business. And it's not an accident. It's intentional. And like I said, we need that to exist as a spectrum. All of these tinier venues rely on the bigger venues in order to have that flow of artists go through. We rely on each other as part of an ecosystem. And if one part of that comes in and really actively disrupts that for intentional reasons, for money reasons, we lose that space for us to be able to have that artist who starts from the DIY scene, grows through the house scene, gets to the small stages, and gets up onto the main stage. It's really happening in every other community. Nashville, Austin, DC, all these places that had in huge vibrant music economies and a whole spectrum where people could develop their entire image, those artists are fleeing those places now. We have more performing musicians and more venues in Portland than we do in Nashville. And that's not because Portland's doing great. It's because Nashville is struggling. And honestly, what I'm hearing from the venue owners and artists that in Nashville is that Live Nation played an enormous component of that.
Thank you for tuning into KBOO News. I'm your reporter, Zach Jones-Murray, and as always, it was a privilege and a pleasure. Till next time.
You are listening to KBOO News and Review. I'm Althea Billings. This past week, we've been looking back at some of our favorite and most impactful stories from 2024. Tonight, that continues, but with an eye towards the future as we get into 2025. This next story is also from August, just after Portland police busted up a street racing event in North Portland. You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Going into the first weekend in August, Portland police warned the public of a coming street takeover where folks from around the Northwest would be gathering on Portland streets to race cars illegally. Police say they were largely successful in shutting down these events, but that Portland remains an attractive destination for these kinds of things, and that's partly because of its infrastructure, or lack thereof. To explore the greater context and some long-term solutions, I'm joined today by Sarah Iannarone, the Executive Director of the Street Trust, Oregon's leading safe streets advocacy group. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. What was your first reaction to hearing about the street takeover that was planned for the first weekend in August?
I live in an area within hearing distance of I-205, 82nd Avenue, 92nd Avenue. So for us, street racing happens all the time. The fact that there was going to be a major takeover wasn't surprising. We've had these periodically in our city. It was interesting to see Portland police activating around this particular one. I'm not sure what incentivized that, but it was nice to see them taking an interest in keeping our streets safe. As you know, we're facing an epidemic of traffic fatalities on Portland streets, and we do need to make sure that they're safe for everyone, regardless of how they're traveling around them.
Well, let's get into that. What kind of dangers do these type of events pose for drivers, pedestrians, and cyclists?
Well, they're reckless and deadly, as we've seen. And honestly, they have a lot of impacts that people don't really may not realize. They damage the street. There was a street takeover near Lloyd Center, where my office is, a few months ago, and the infrastructure's absolutely wrecked. You can't see the bike lanes, you can't see the center lanes, you can't see even some of the curbs are a little damaged. So apart from the impact to human health and safety, it does affect our infrastructure, leaves particulate matter. I'm guessing it's pretty bad for the air quality of the bystanders as well, not to mention just the threats of a crash. It's really dangerous and deadly. Mm-hmm.
Well, the Street Trust has highlighted that PPB's law enforcement approach to this sort of event isn't necessarily the most effective. Obviously, they continue to happen, even though folks do get arrested and their cars repossessed and stuff like that. What are some alternatives?
So the Street Trust has long taken an approach that while law enforcement, we have traffic laws for a reason, so we want them enforced, there are a lot more equitable ways for us to enforce the laws and ensure safety on our streets. So one of the things that we advocated back when we had Commissioner Joanne Hardesty at the head of transportation was automated traffic enforcement, which we understand can be administered more equitably. We know that Portland police still disproportionately stop Black Portlanders in particular. Even most recent stats have that. So who the Portland police choose to stop or not is very subjective, and we believe that automated traffic enforcement can be more objective, potentially, if designed right and implemented right. We also believe that fines could be scaled based on the vehicle value or even income, like they do in some countries. But apart from that, we believe that prevention is the best strategy. And there's so many ways we can approach this through a public health lens, which is really important because infrastructure is one piece, but all consumer protections we think about, whether it's seat belts or child caps on medicine, are there to help us prevent vulnerable people from inadvertently harming themselves or others. And we really want to design a transportation system that makes sure that even if there is human error, it's not just someone being distracted because they're on their cell phone while operating a motor vehicle. Maybe a bee flies into their car, right? We've all had that situation where something happens or someone jumps out in front of us, or maybe it's even an animal and we're startled. We want to make sure that there are protections in place so that someone who happens to be walking there maybe isn't killed. This is why we think about protecting people from different modes, separated bike lanes, raised sidewalks, and even thinking about keeping high volume, fast traffic separated from humans who are outside of automobiles. For instance, highways. You don't see people walking and biking on highways, or they're not supposed to be. So why would we have streets designed that could be used at highway speeds through places where people live, work, and play? Many of our streets, especially in East County, if you think about Marine Drive or any of the Strodes, as they're known, which are supposed to be streets, but they function as roads, they're really deadly, and people don't even understand, most people using the streets, operating a motor vehicle, walking or biking, that for every few miles faster that a motor vehicle is going when it collides with a human, the likelihood of that human surviving the crash precipitously drops, even at 5 and 10 mile per hour increments. And on top of that, the increased size of many of these vehicles, and humans just aren't surviving that collision with the automobile. So we really need to slow down these streets for everyday use, and those streets wouldn't be conducive to these types of street takeovers. It would be impossible to take them over.
Well, you were mentioning some of the qualities of these streets, and so many of them are in Portland's high crash network, where this stuff is happening and has a long legacy of being really dangerous for folks using the road in all types of different ways. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of the high crash network, and, you know, what progress have you seen Portland make towards dealing with those, or what still needs to be done?
To PBOT's credit, I do want to point your listeners toward the PBOT Equity Matrix, where they have done a nice job of identifying these high crash corridors and intersections. And they've also identified high equity areas, which are places where the first language spoken at home may not be English, where people living in lower incomes reside, where BIPOC communities reside. And so overlaying those in the equity map to target investments in those areas. And they have worked to make targeted investments, especially in East Portland and Northeast Portland. But one of the problems is that these streets are still far too conducive to fast-moving motor vehicles. So as I said, just a few miles, a car going 45 or 50 down one of these wide roadways, which all of us have seen, could be a life or death choice over just going 25 or 30, and we haven't done enough to reduce speeds in these areas. And you can't only do that through behavior change. You need to do it through infrastructure. You don't see people moving at those speeds at 22nd and Division at the rate that you do at 122nd Division, and that's design. It's the same car, right? They're moving from one end of the corridor to another. Another piece really would be driver education and safety education. I think a lot of these younger drivers in particular are maybe getting basic driver ed in school, but they're not really understanding the impacts of their choices on their own lives, what that could mean for their future employment if they get a criminal record from this activity, what that could mean for their families, the costs if they actually end up hurting someone or hurting themselves, what that could mean for them. So we could do a lot more intervention the same way we put, you know, warnings on cigarette packs and restrict youth from having access to that. We don't want people doing things inadvertently that harm them when they may not know that it's harmful.
Well, right, especially thinking about street racing, this is sort of thrill-seeking behavior that attracts definitely a younger crowd. Is that something, do you know if that's been done, that kind of education has been done for drivers other places?
Well, we've seen it effective, and not to over-index on smoking, but we have seen over decades where a concerted investment to reduce smoking through a variety of enforcement and education mechanisms really does help move the needle on a public health situation. And that's why the Street Trust calls for us treating traffic violence and reckless driving as a public health epidemic. And we need those supports in place so that from very early age, we really glamorize driving now. Now that I work in traffic safety, I can even be watching, like, say, a cartoon with a young friend, you know, or someone in my community, and you see this car chase and it's really funny and someone's getting crashed up, and I have a visceral reaction. I don't like seeing that, because I know in my everyday life, if that happens, there's a family on the receiving end of that violence whose life is irreversibly affected sometimes. And so I do think that we need to think more holistically about what we glamorize in terms of mobility in our communities, and how we can make some of the other modes more exciting. And also, young people are just going to thrill seek. It's what they do. Sometimes you'll hear, oh, these kids are skateboarding too fast, or they're riding their bikes too fast, or they're riding their e-bikes too fast. And honestly, I think we need to create spaces for them to be able to do some of this stuff, not disinvesting in parks and recreation areas. But what would it mean to host an invitational at the Portland Raceway, potentially, right? And just let them use it. Could we fund that instead of funding police, and instead of them doing this on a public street? You know, I don't know if we could insure it, but I do think there are people who know more about that who could get creative with our investments and make sure that they are heading folks in the right direction.
Yeah, I was very interested to hear about this more equity-centered approach in terms of law enforcement. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, that racial profiling of Portland police is a pretty well-known phenomenon here that they haven't effectively been able to address. So the automated traffic enforcement is one approach. But I also think that when we focus our investments to prevent this racing in those high equity areas, we'll have more equitable outcomes. So you see some improvements on 82nd Avenue. We need to see them on the entire high crash network with urgency. Marine Drive in particular is quite deadly. And I guess when the police say this place is attractive for that racing, it's because we have roads like that that they see as wide open spaces where they can do this behavior. If we didn't have those, they wouldn't be able to do it.
Right, like you mentioned, they're not racing 22nd and Division.
Yeah.
What kind of efforts have been made at the state level to address street racing?
So back in 2023, back when Governor Kotek was still in the House, they did pass more strict consequences for people who were caught doing this. That included increased jail time and even vehicle forfeiture. So I do think law enforcement has more tools. On the flip side, I don't like to see any young people funneled into our criminal justice system unnecessarily when that could be prevented. It has serious consequences for their life outcomes subsequently. So what we want to do is invest in keeping them out of that behavior in the first place, so that they understand there could be really serious consequences at the other end of their decisions, including life or death for them or others, and see if we can steer them in a different direction through, again, education, behavior change, and encouragement in other areas. That said, I do think that some countries have done a better job of making sure that, I use the word recidivism, but there are a small subset of the population who engage in this behavior again and again. And what we see is really serious consequences for folks that aren't carceral. For instance, vehicle forfeiture, losing your license, and even speed regulators and other things that would be installed on your vehicle, similar to if you're a repeat offender for driving while intoxicated, so that you're actually, the cars just aren't allowed to go that fast. So we know that the technology exists. We geofence the scooters so they can't go in parks, and we have speed regulators on e-bikes, and I'm not sure why we don't use that technology for motor vehicles as well. That would be a federal issue though, not the state.
Right, right. Well, like you mentioned, systemic problems, systemic solutions, and traffic calming is one of those. What are some of the criteria that you assess those on?
Well, leading with race is really important. So if you talk to the folks at Multnomah County Health Department, who've really been doing a great job in our community, leading with race is critical to make sure that you have equitable outcomes with whatever you're doing, but in particular, public health. It helps us design a system that's going to be more equitable for most people. The example that we often use is the sidewalk curb cut, right? The little ramp at the edge. So instead of having to step down the curb, you can just roll easily into the street. Well, those are designed for ADA access for people using a mobility device like a wheelchair. Think about how your life has improved because they're there, whether you're pulling a kid in a wagon, pushing a stroller, maybe pulling a shopping cart, you know, home from the bus stop. They make your life easier, or even have a broken leg, right? So when we make interventions based on people who are most harmed by the system, we all benefit. So if we were to look at the data and make those interventions in urban space and education around ameliorating racial disparities, we would start to chip away at this problem. But I feel like Portland has a hard time just making that commitment and doubling down on it. We tend to equivocate a little bit. We say Black Lives Matter, but then we don't spend the money and target the investments to make sure that they do and that people aren't killed through a lack of investment, which is basically why we have the public health epidemic.
Well, in the advocacy work that you do, do you encounter misconceptions that people may have about how to make streets safer?
I don't know if it's so much misconceptions, but what we do know is that transportation and safe streets aren't really even in people's top 10 priorities for the way that they're looking at the safety of our communities. And we know that the streets are the lifelines of our communities. You can't get from home to work or home to school or home to your doctor without them, a transportation system. So community mobility should be built into our housing crisis, our public health crisis, and even just thinking about all of the challenges we've had around, say, ADA access to sidewalks and camping, right? So thinking about streets as part of the livability equation is really important, and we need to get the public more aware of that. At the end of the day, I think most people don't understand that cars slowing down is so critical. Again, if a car runs into me going 20 miles per hour, I might have a chance of surviving. You hit 40, that's like a fraction of that chance. So really slowing down every 5 miles per hour, every 10 miles per hour really counts, even at 40, 30, 20. So we often say 20 is plenty. And we really do think that where there are people walking, rolling, biking, trying to access transit, people driving should go very, very, very slowly. So, and also one of the things that we need to understand is that we are horrible at funding our transportation system. Per household, we pay the least of the Western states. The only worse state than us is Montana. So compared to, say, California or even Utah or Idaho, Oregonians are not really paying for our transportation system in the way that would make us allow us to pay for these improvements. So we really need to commit in the 2025 legislative session to move Oregon forward through a more concerted safe streets investment strategy for all of us, because it doesn't end at City of Portland. You've got Gresham at one side, you know, Washington County, Clackamas County, and our friends across the state don't have safe streets either. And as much as we like spending billions of dollars on highway mega projects, I think we should be spending billions of dollars on a complete streets, Main Street strategy for all of us to move about safely and have a happy, healthy life.
Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
That was Sarah Iannarone, the executive director of the Street Trust, Oregon's leading safe streets advocacy group. We're talking about some of what her organization does, especially in light of the recent street takeover that Portland police busted up the first weekend in August. You are listening to KBOO News in Review. I'm Althea Billings. Now we'll go to a special edition of the Global Citizen International Digest from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Last year at about this time, I identified 10 issues and a wild card, Trump's election, as the main items on a global citizen agenda. Most of these issues will be with us next year and for years afterward. Global warming and related environmental crises, U.S.-China tensions, challenges to democracy and peace in Europe and Africa, interstate and intrastate violence in the Middle East, more nuclear weapons. A new addition to this list is another Trump administration, which creates the potential for exceptional chaos in the U.S. and worldwide. Wars in Europe and the Middle East show no sign of ending. At extraordinary cost in lives and the economy, Russia plows ahead in its effort to exterminate Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has been declared a war criminal by the International Criminal Court, but he isn't going to be arrested. He shows no interest in anything other than a victor's peace. With Donald Trump's help, he may get it, a sizable chunk of Ukraine's territory in exchange for a halt to the fighting. European supporters of Ukraine will be under mounting pressure at home to bring the war to a close and reduce Europe's cost. 2025 could be the year Ukraine is forced to barter land for peace, as President Zelensky lately says he's open to discussing if Ukraine can be protected from future Russian aggression. In the second year of Israel's war with Hamas, we once again hear talk about a ceasefire agreement that would lead to an exchange of hostages for prisoners. Maybe. But the main stories in 2025 will be about Israel's expansion into the occupied territories, Lebanon and Syria, the terrible destruction in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there, both of which will take generations to repair, and turmoil in Israeli politics as the far right under Benjamin Netanyahu seeks not only to establish a greater Israel by force of arms, but also to resurrect its anti-democracy project in the name of judicial reform. Politics in Iran and Syria are bound to be tumultuous. In Iran, as contending forces debate support of Hezbollah, confronting Israel, the nuclear option, and relations with the United States. And in Syria, as the victorious HTS decide what kind of society should replace Assad's terror regime and what Syria's relations should be with the major powers and with its Middle East neighbors. The Chinese characterize the last few years in world affairs as turbulent. U.S.-China relations are something of an exception. Beijing considers relations to have largely stabilized, thanks to Joe Biden. But with Donald Trump's election, China is preparing for renewed economic and strategic competition in 2025. Trump has promised to resume the trade war he began in his first term, and which Joe Biden continued. But this time around, Trump will aim at a decoupling of the two countries' economies, despite the significant costs to consumers and U.S. industries that many economists are predicting. China will not back down in this war. Far from it, China has plenty of trade and investment options in Europe and the global South. Tension over Taiwan, already considerable during the last year, is likely to ratchet up as the trade war with the U.S. intensifies and Taiwan's new president reinforces his message on the island nation's sovereignty. Elsewhere in Asia, a civil war in Myanmar may be decided in the new year between the military junta and various ethnic and political rebels. South Korea will have a new president following the failed martial law order of the current president. And India's Narendra Modi will be buffeted by increasingly undemocratic rule and unsteady relations with China along their border. North Korea will, as usual, be unpredictable. Will its close security ties with Russia make Kim Jong-un more of a risk-taker? Or will he again be amenable to a deal with Trump that gains sanctions relief in return for putting his nuclear arsenal in a verifiably safe warehouse? U.S. foreign policy under Donald Trump will follow the pattern of his previous administration, but against a different background than in the past. The making of foreign and national security policy will be much more centralized, with the intelligence community and the State Department marginalized. But it will also be more unpredictable, with Elon Musk acting like a second president. The China threat will be front and center, relations with Russia will become friendlier, and strongman rule will be admired. Climate change, human rights, good relations with Canada and Mexico, security coalitions in the Asia-Pacific, foreign economic aid, and adherence to international law will all have low priority. By contrast, a racist immigration policy, balancing of the trade deficit, attraction of foreign investment, and energy policy crafted by the oil and gas industry will have Trump's total attention and support. Traditional allies around the world, understanding full well how Trump operates, will be looking to their own resources when it comes to everything from dealing with Russia to combating climate change. On climate change, international agreements will now have one less proponent as Trump again pulls the United States out of the Paris agreements on global warming limits. The recently concluded COP29 summit included pledges of $300 billion in annual contributions to low-income countries to fight climate change, but those pledges, insufficient as they are, will have much less chance of being honored with the U.S. absent from the table. Trump will also undo many of Biden's environmental protection accomplishments at home. The Biden administration has just promised, for instance, that the U.S. will slash planet warming pollution at least 61% compared with 2005 levels by 2035, but that promise stands no chance of being kept with Trump in charge. The global environmental picture is unlikely to improve even with greater international cooperation. In the past year, a global plastic treaty has failed, methane buildup in the atmosphere has risen dramatically, and glaciers in the Antarctic and Greenland are melting at record paces, contributing importantly to global sea level rise. China, despite being a leader in alternative energy, is an outlier as a developing country. It will be the top carbon emitter by century's end. The production and refinement of nuclear weapons, rather than their elimination, is another enduring feature of the global agenda. The U.S., Russia, and China are engaged in expensive nuclear weapon modernization programs rather than renewing or expanding nuclear arms control agreements. North Korea is enlarging its nuclear weapon missile arsenal. One or more Middle East country might join Iran in having nuclear energy facilities that could potentially produce a weapon. Perhaps the single most disturbing global trend is the evisceration of democracy around the world. One-party states and authoritarian political systems are those most likely to defy international law, repress human rights, and ignore the environment and social injustice. Almost needless to say, we are now the primary example of democratic decline. How the American example influences politics abroad will be important to watch in 2025. The more Trump and the MAGA Republicans undermine democracy at home, the stronger are the oligarchies, kleptocracies, and far-right parties abroad. If constitutions, presidential restraint, and the rule of law are discounted in the arsenal of democracy, they are likely to be discounted by authoritarian rulers and extremist parties elsewhere. The drift to the right in many parts of Europe, Hungary, France, Romania, Turkey, Georgia, Italy, and possibly Germany, will surely be strengthened by Trump's win here. Look, for example, at the reaction in Germany to Elon Musk's endorsement of the AfD party, an anti-immigrant party with neo-Nazi leanings, in next year's national election. Human rights in China will also be affected. Unrestrained by criticism from the U.S., the European Union, or the United Nations, China will reinforce its status as the surveillance state in Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Tibet, as well as in the main provinces, and as an exporter of surveillance equipment and police training to some 50 countries. Taken together, these events show that the planet's insecurity has deepened. War, political upheavals, a climate crisis, and reliance on nuclear weapons have all taken turns for the worst. Repression and social injustice continue to thrive. Here and there we can find notable advances in dealing with poverty and global warming, and there are plenty of sound ideas for conflict prevention and resolution, arms control, and fulfillment of basic human rights. But the more powerful people and organizations remain self-interested and, thanks to advances in technology, able to flood the world with misinformation and provocations. 2025 promises to be a particularly challenging year for global-minded citizens. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening and best wishes for a peaceful new year.
You've been listening to KBOO News in Review. I'm Althea Billings. In this episode, we've been looking back at some of our favorite and most impactful stories from 2024, but with an eye towards the future as we enter 2025. Tomorrow, our regular newscast returns, so look forward to that. But before we send it off, we've got to hear a news poem. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael always looks both ways before crossing years.
Could we get a do-over on 2024? The presidential campaign, most certainly. Biden drops out early, the Dems hold primaries, and choose a charismatic, semi-progressive white male. But what else could change? Would it make any difference if Hamas hadn't attacked Israel in October? Could a handful of billionaires tell select Congress folks and senators to increase their taxes or they wouldn't get reelected? Would any of the things that got worse this year get better the next? The climate and its connected extreme weather, from flooding to drought, too cold to too hot. Will the various wars, Gaza, Ukraine, Yemen, etc., get any better? There's sure to be a couple new ones. More people will starve, more people will succumb to pandemics, including one or two no one had heard of. While there's bound to be some unexpected disasters, is this the year someone explodes a nuclear bomb? There could be some unexpected positives, like truly green power, protein that doesn't require torturing animals or applying toxic chemicals to the earth. We know the past. Not knowing the future gives me a chance. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots, from energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the evening news, weekdays at 5 p.m. here on 90.7 KBOO Portland.
To Sojourner Truth, thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, on our weekly broadcast, a roundtable discussion on what we have learned thus far as Trump